Chapter 17, we're going to talk about, it's really introduced and it's concluded in chapter 19, to how the city of Rome is viewed from heaven, and in chapter 19, we're going to see it destroyed along with the other enemies of God. Actually, 18 is destroyed. But more than that, I think we're introduced to one of the greatest allies of Satan, one of the most dangerous allies of Satan. And that he uses. And so I begin with this question. And as I said, I'm not in a rush today. I think we can get done with this chapter. But who is the Christian's most dangerous enemy in Revelation? You got several choices. Okay, that's one of the beasts, which is on here. What about their leader, the dragon? Satan himself. Is he the greatest enemy? He's the one that gives the marching orders. He's the one that gets those to do the things that directs them in what they need to do. The false prophet or false religions. One, in this case, in this book, for these Christians of this time period, they were forcing man to worship the beast. And the beast, as Carrie's already made mention, is the government, which is the one that persecutes Christians. But there's a fourth, and that's who we're going to deal with today, ally of Satan, and that's the harlot. In this case, as we're going to see, it's probably the city of Rome. I think the description that's given and some hints that are given is probably indicative of the fact that we're dealing with the city of Rome. And I don't know if it's the city of Rome, per se, but it's what the city of Rome represents to the world. And in this case, and it's been the case down through the centuries, what the city of Rome represents is worldliness, and all that, and I should have, that worldly man holds most precious. What they view as most important, which is wealth, power, worldly respect. This is what the city of Rome, the harlot, represents. And there's always been a harlot, in my mind, down through the centuries, that has been there as an ally of Satan. And sooner or later, just like the harlot in Revelation, the harlot will fall, but there will be another that will take his place. Because Satan has his allies. And he uses them. And they're usually in this category, these categories. So whom do you think is the most dangerous ally of Satan for a Christian? What's that? Okay, we ourselves, okay?
That's why we're driven by.
Okay, all right.
Man's pride.
Man's pride, okay.
Our wants.
Our wants. So, I think we're all saying the same things, that the harlot, worldliness, is a great temptation for Christians. It is a great temptation. And I just wonder how many Christians that have attended all the services and laid by in store and sung all the songs are going to get before God, and God's going to say, like Jesus said in Matthew, "Depart from me, for I never knew you." And it's going to be because of being worldly. And it's interesting in this chapter how worldliness is portrayed. And remember in chapter 17, this is from a heavenly view. This is from John in heaven looking down. And so when we get this picture of the harlot in just a few moments that represents worldliness, he's amazed, it says. He is shocked by the picture because that's not what he expected. And boy, is there a lesson there. Many lessons there for us today. Then one of the seven angels who had seven bowls came and talked with me, saying, "Come and I will show you the judgment on the great harlot who sits on many waters." The harlot, I believe, as we're going to see here in a second, is indeed Rome. We can see this in the description of this chapter. In the Old Testament, the description is given to God's enemies and cities. You have Nahum chapter 3, verses 1 and 4. Of Nineveh, as it describes Nineveh, and Jeremiah chapter 51, as it describes Babylon. "Woe to the bloody city, it is all full of lies and robbery. Its victim never departs because of the multitude of harlotries of the seductive harlot, the mistress of sorcerers, who sells nations through her harlotries and families through her sorceries. And we see that the description, and we're going to take a look at the description here as we go through the first few verses. Sitting on many waters, originally with Babylon, it was talking about all the canals. The original Babylon sat in the middle of a river. And so there were canals that were running all through. And when they closed the gates where the river came in, they had a huge gate. Then the river actually went around Babylon. And there was no way of getting into it, because once you got past the river, there was nothing there but a huge wall. And so Babylon, the cry of Babylon was that they could not be overthrown. And then a few hundred years later, army came in and dammed the river from up above Babylon. They lowered the gates, but it didn't go the whole way to the bottom, because they let the water still come in so they could have drinking water when they were under siege. And then the army just marched in under the gates and took Babylon in one night, the original city. And so that it sat, originally the description was this idea of it sitting on many canals. But in verse 15 of this chapter, the waters are identified as people. Then he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits, this is verse 15 of this chapter, are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. So this is the city that is controlling the world. And at this time, it's Rome. But even more than that, we have some other descriptions of them. With whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. Kings, the earthly rulers, had participated with her politically, economically, culturally, religiously. Why would countries want to participate with Rome? Why would they want to become the allies of Rome? What did Rome have to offer? Wealth and prosperity. Yep, same reason people won't be allies with us today. What else would that represent? What else did they give to the nations?
Power, security.
Remember, we already talked about the fact that they were a bully. And the reason they were a bully is because they had the most powerful army in the world at that time. And so they could protect people. And if you think about it, and again, you know, it's just the comparisons to the United States today. Think about all the nations around the world that we're allies with that do not have to spend money on an army, because they have made what with us? A treaty. And we're going to defend them. And so they don't spend very much money on their armies. We do, because we are going to defend them. The same thing with Rome. That's why they want to be friends. Not because they like us. Not because those countries liked Rome. Is what they had to offer. Here we see that. And then the inhabitants of the earth also had become drunk with her power and worldliness. And they were intoxicated. The people of the world were intoxicated with the lusts and material possessions and comforts that she offered to any who would submit and follow her. There's indication we find all the time, ships that have sunk at sea that were heading to Rome and things that have been unearthed, that they could get whatever they wanted. They had these lines of buying and selling all set up so they could get everything from all over the world. They wanted a spice that was only made in Africa, they got it. If they wanted clothes that was only made in the Middle East, they got it. It was an incredible. The roads of Rome. This is one of the reasons that you know we say that Christ was born during this time, because you could travel anywhere. Their roads were extensive. The roads were smooth, and they were all over the world. Bricks. Rocks that were absolutely, there was no up and down bouncing or anything. It was absolute. Their engineering feats, as I mentioned last week, is incredible. And so all this commerce was shipped all over the empire. People could get what they wanted. Live a very comfortable life. Does that sound familiar? Live a very comfortable life. People became intoxicated with that.
I think that's comparable to the time of
Yeah, it's comparable to all times down through the centuries, the ruling power. You can go to when the Mongols, they had this huge, vast commerce empire and the Silk Road in which stuff was transported, but they were the ones in charge of that. And so the ruling nations, usually that's the case down through the centuries. And the world's always going to flock to the wealthy and the powerful. And over time, people become drunk, many times without even realizing it. They become boiled alive. And notice that phrase, inhabitants of the earth. Who might that include if you're not careful? Christians. Where's Kevin? Okay. Who might that include? Christians. Yeah. Inhabitants of the earth would include anybody living on the face of the earth. And so Christians have to be careful that they do not become so intoxicated with worldliness. They do not become so intoxicated with worldliness that and it will happen very quickly. Can you fix this? Okay. Got to have my pictures and got to have my PowerPoint. Yeah, go ahead.
There's also one reason for each generation to teach the next generation, because usually when major collapses in people's faith in the world, usually catches up with Christians a generation later because they don't teach.
Yes. And one of the most dangerous statements for any Christian parent to make is this statement. I want to give my children everything I never had. And that's in relation to material things. That's a dangerous statement, brethren. Because you know who's going to help us accomplish that goal? Satan will. And then you lose your children. The next generation. And so it makes sure as Christians we give our children what we had, which is the raising and the nurture and admonition in God's Word. That should be the focus. And so, yeah, this is very, very dangerous. And I think probably the greatest ally of Satan. Lessons, we've already talked about it. Warning then on this one powerful verse for any and all American Christians. Very, very powerful. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. Verse 4, the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and all the filthiness of her fornication. And so I want to center on just verse 4 because I want to make application. I was thinking this week as I was reviewing this chapter and all my notes on it, that if I ever preach a lesson on worldliness, I'm just going to preach Revelation 17. This is the greatest sermon on worldliness and the dangers of worldliness. Okay? And so I just want to concentrate on verse 4 and how this woman is presented. Notice again verse 4. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. How was she presented? She's alluring. How else? Remember, this is the heavenly view of the harlot.
She was rich.
She was rich.
She was powerful.
Powerful. She is absolutely beautiful. To the eye, she is beautiful. I would expect the heavenly view would be one of just ugliness. But if she was ugly, who would want to go to her? If she was not powerful, who would want to go to her? Nobody. But you notice how this woman is presented. Not as you would expect, nor as John expected. She is appealing. She is successful in a worldly way. Yes, wanting to have everybody come unto her. Her outward appearance is attractive, which makes her more appealing to the worldly, materialistic mind. And the danger in this is what? Yeah, spiritual adultery and fornication. There's another danger to this for Christians, which is what? If you're not careful, what?
Pick that over God.
You're going to pick that over God. I want my children. I want to give my children everything I never had. I want to give them a great education so they can go out and get a great job, so that they can make a lot of money, so they can live comfortably in this life. Hopefully none of us have said that. But many do. What have you forgotten? It's not about this life. Is it really even about how we live in this life? But that's what many parents, Christian parents, are meaning when they say, I want to give them everything that I never had. Because that's what looks good, isn't it? That's such a good life in this life.
Yeah, and
Jesus says we're going to be persecuted, that we're going to have difficulties in this life. There are so many that counter this idea. And I just want to, I didn't have this coming in individually, but I just want to take a look at 1 Timothy 2, verses 9 and 10. You see the description of the harlot and how she is presented and how she represents herself. And then you go over to 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 9 and 10, where Paul says of women in like manner also that the woman adorn themselves in modest apparel with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. Look at the way the comparison between a godly woman and the harlot here. A Christian and the world. I think when you compare Revelation 17 and the picture of the harlot with what Paul says in 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 9 and 10, when a person, you need to decide this for yourself. But when a person looks at a Christian, whether it be female or male, there should be a difference between the way we appear and the way we act. The question is there? And that's something we need to struggle, we probably will struggle with all of our lives. Because we live in Rome. We live with the harlot in this century.
Being allured by the world and wanting our kids to have things we didn't have, we need to also watch for ourselves, because the world wants us to, you know, not be happy with what we have. It leads to divorce. It leads to separation. Focusing on listening to what people around you say about your happiness, and it's all about you and getting what you want. And, this is contrary to what Christians are, the life of Christians are to live.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I don't have up here, but I may add to my notes. How do you define happiness? Yeah. Okay, but how do you define it specifically?
Well, I mean, as Christian, I define it as being right with God. Because, you know, like Solomon said in the book of Ecclesiastes, chasing after the wind, things of the world, it's not going to make you happy.
Yeah, but I absolutely agree. But I'm asking each and every individual in here to, in their own minds, to define it. What happens if you don't have air conditioning? What happens if you're struggling to get food? Are you going to be happy or are you going to be unhappy? What if you don't have the nicest clothes? What if you can't go to the nicest, to the best movies that just come? What happens if you can't drive one of the newest vehicles? What happens if your house is not exactly, is what we might call a fixer-upper that we haven't been able to fix up? Are you going to be unhappy or are you going to be happy? We are blessed beyond, from whatever state we find ourselves in, therewith.
Be content.
Be content.
That's what I was getting ready to say. You know, our attitude's got to be different than the attitude of the world.
Yeah. And so I just kind of asked, throw that out there for you to think about. How do you define happiness?
You know that God will provide, too.
We do. But is it that we want Him to provide the biggest and the best, the nicest, the most luxurious, the one that is most fashionable? Is that what we want? And parents, is that what we want to give our children? I don't want my child. I have heard Christian parents say, I don't want my child to stick out at school. Well, you better be careful because they may just blend right in all ways. Warning. The warning of Revelation chapter 17 is here. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Just a quick note on that. I cannot recall a single parent whom I have heard that say that, whose children are faithful today.
Yeah. Such a dangerous, dangerous statement. And on her forehead, a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. Verse 5. Why does it start with the word mystery? That caught my attention. First time I went through this book. Mystery. Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the world. Why does he use the word mystery? Why is this written on her forehead? What do you think?
I think it's because he uses Babylon to contrast with the Babylon taking Judah, the southern kingdom, in captivity because of Judah's disobedience.
Okay, could be. Jim?
A mystery is something concealed, and she looks appealing. But yet there's the mystery that's revealed. It isn't what you're expecting.
I think that's it. Sin and its consequences can be destructive to those who are doing them. That is why it is mysterious as to why people would want to sin. The consequences of sin are death. And sooner or later, if you're participating in sin, you're going to pay the consequences in this life. And if not in this life, although I've only been alive 57 years, but I have seen that this is almost always the case in this life, sooner or later. Sometimes it may take years, but sooner or later, you pay the consequence. But if not in this life, then in the next. So it's a mystery. Why would anybody want to participate? And I think there's a reason. I don't have it on here, and we'll talk about it in just a second. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 8 through 10. Notice what Paul says there. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, which is what we're talking about in Revelation, with all power, signs, and notice what's said there. Lying wonders. Look wonderful. But it's a lie. And with all unrighteous deception among those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. This is why it's a mystery. Why would anybody want to participate in that? Why would somebody want to participate in that? It's appealing. For when?
At the moment.
For today. What did Paul say in Philippians? Did he concentrate on today? Where was his attention placed? I pressed towards the high mark of my calling, that which is in front of me. He never lost sight of. That's what Satan wants us to do. He wants to take our eyes off of what lies in front of us and be concerned about today. This is the worst enemy. This is the greatest ally, I believe, that Satan has. Outwardly, yeah, go ahead.
Chapter 11, Moses rejected Egypt. He refused the pleasures of sin for a season. It does give pleasure.
Yes, it does.
And that's locked. It's what comes after.
That's exactly right. Outwardly, this is appealing. Outwardly, it is appealing. And it is. If sin was just if it made you feel terrible when you committed sin, if you got sick, if it was something that caused, nobody would want to do it. But sin is appealing.
Them crashing and burning from the sin, they're like, oh, but that won't happen to me.
That's a good
point. I can control it. I'm tough. I can handle it. And so, and then until it gets to be too late, and then they discover it.
It's not going to hurt me or my family.
But as you said, if you live long enough, you see that eventually, I mean, now some of these guys live rock star lives and they live 70, 80 plus years,
okay.
but a lot of times they don't.
So. That's right. And a lot of times they live not very happy.
Right. Most of the time. Right?
Yeah. Most of the time they don't live happy.
But even if you did, even if you could somehow, you know, manage to escape all of the consequences of sin, which obviously you can, but then it still wouldn't be worth it.
No, you're exactly right. And I just reminded over and over so many times, and I remind myself that statement, Mark McCurry, we had for a gospel meeting one time, and Mark stood up here and he said, what does it matter if for 80 or 90 years you live in the eyes of the world, a miserable life, and you struggle to survive, and you just have problems every single day of your life, what will it matter after 10,000 years in heaven? How will those 80 or 90 years feel after 10,000 years in heaven? And that's the blink of an eye for eternity. That's a blink of an eye. You forget. That will be, you will never even remember that. 100,000 years in heaven. But after, how is it going to feel? And then you take a look at the opposite of that. How's it going to feel after 10,000 years in hell of living 80 or 90 years in comfort and luxury and be taken care of?
Okay, there was a rich man. He wasn't there very long.
And all he wanted was a drop of water.
Yeah.
When a person understands, though, the end result of sin, it becomes a mystery as to why people would want to become entangled with the world. Remember, though, a lot of times worldliness for people and Christians is like that frog that's boiled alive. It starts out slow and gradually increases until the frog doesn't even realize it and is dead. Same way with worldliness.
Ingrained in our society for so long that people don't want to fight them. They don't want to question them. Like in, you know, in textbooks, in millions of years ago.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. They've heard accepted. That for so long that it's become ingrained into them.
Yep.
And it hurts to try to pull away from that.
The old Soviet Union used to say, you give us a child at the age of 5, and by the time they're 13, they're a communist for all their lives. Yep. It's only 8 years. It's called indoctrination. And that's what Satan tries to do today. Yep. He even persecuted Christians, held the coats of the men that stoned Stephen. I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. This is that verse. He marvels with great amazement when he looks at this woman. Why would he have been astonished? Because he expected to see a scene of judgment. He expected to see this ugly individual. But here is what she's seeing. What he is seeing is this beautiful, beautiful, appealing woman. And he is amazed by that. But that's how worldliness appears to people today, and if not careful, to Christians. 1 John 2:15-17, I think is applicable here. Do not love the world or the things of the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away, and the lust of it. But he who does the will of God abides forever. Now, I'm just going to be totally honest with you, and before we continue with this, because we're going to, we've been talking about the lessons and warnings to Christians, and don't even become entangled with worldliness, and we've got to be constantly on our on guard, or we're going to be boiled alive. But this is this last part. it is difficult to live in the world and not become a part of the world. I'm just going to tell you, it's difficult for that to happen. It's difficult over time. It's difficult. I'm a father of four. My children are raised out of my house, but I struggle with the same thing I'm talking about this morning. It's difficult to not look at my children and not say, I want them to be successful. I want them to live comfortably in this life. It's difficult to do that. But you have to make sure you give them first that Christian upbringing. I'm going to use the same word I just used what the world tries to do. You need to indoctrinate them. You need to indoctrinate them. Because that's exactly what Deuteronomy chapter 6 is talking about. You're supposed to teach your children when? Once a day. When they rise up. When they walk by the way. When they go into the house. And when they lie down. How often do you teach them during the day? That's indoctrination. But I have no problem with that when it comes to my God. I have no problem with that. Because a problem I will have is on the day of judgment if I'm standing before God and I see my children and He doesn't know their name. That will cause pain. But the angel said to me, why did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast that you saw was and is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and is yet to come. Yeah.
Being drunk with the blood of the saints. So you know, to get drunk, you have to do it in excess, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it tells me, like you were talking about earlier, a lot of the saints fell prey to this allurement of this woman.
In this case, it's persecution, I think, but at the same time, she could, you know, in today's world, we are not persecuted. Christians are not persecuted by this country, but our country could become drunk with the blood of the saints in terms of physically and an analogy that they're causing Christians to fall away, to accept homosexuality as being okay, to accept and be open to anybody that wants to do anything. You know, there's a new thought in our country. It's always been here, but there's a new thought in our country that is a party affiliation, a political party affiliation. And one of the guys on the Five that I like to watch on Fox, Greg. He is, and all of a sudden the name for this, I'm forsaken, the name of the party forsakes me. But his belief is that in public you can't do certain things, but in your own homes you can do whatever you want. And that's starting to seep in to this country. You know, certain things we shouldn't have out in public, but if you want to do it in your home, why not? It's your home. That sounds good. But it's sin. You know, and so, you know, that's how she can become drunk today. And it's interesting to see this beautiful woman sitting on this horrible beast. These verses are probably referring back to chapter 13 and verse 3, where one of the heads had suffered a mortal wound but had recovered. It's talking about that Nero Redivivus myth. Well, the Roman Empire is pictured as personified in its emperors. Nero was and is not. He is dead. And the persecutions of the saints had temporarily ended. However, there's going to be another one come out, and it's Domitian. And they're all going to go into, and that's chapter 13, verse 3, where we talked about that. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. Verse 9, though, here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are the seven mountains on which the woman sits. So, this is a strong passage to indicate the woman is indeed Rome. Rome, the city of Rome, is legendary for being built on, guess what? Seven hills, the seven hills of Rome. And I have them up here. That's the picture of the seven hills of Rome. And the red line is the walls of Rome. All seven hills are represented there. And Rome is legendary for having been described as sitting on seven hills. But, remember what I said, sometimes, you know, you just can't take one verse literally and all the rest symbolically. So how do you discern? So is this really a literal, is we need to take this literal, or do we need to take this symbolic? If, what happens if we take this symbolically? Well, if you take this literal and try to count kings, it is difficult to find Domitian, or the Caesar, the actual Caesar is being referenced to. If you don't start with Julius Caesar as he was a dictator and start with Augustus, then the five fallen, one is and the other is yet to come. When he comes, it will only be a short time. The eighth then would be Domitian. But you have to really twist all of this to get to Domitian. So I don't think you take it literally. So how do you take it symbolically? I like what Caird has to say. Quote, by the same token, the seven kings are a symbolic number, representative of the whole series of emperors. And they would remain seven no matter how long the actual list happens to be. So seven is like a perfect, complete number. So all of them are there. The point being that the imperial line has only a short time to run before the emergence of a new monstrous Nero, an eighth who is one of the seven. But the whole point of this, that they're going to perdition. Some say, well, it could be, you know, I look at it and say, well, some say it could be Domitian who persecuted Christians. But there is a ruler down the road who becomes a Christian, quote unquote. And you remember what he did with the Roman Empire after he became a Christian? He didn't convert them. He did what? He commanded that everybody in the Roman Empire become a what? Christian. Does anybody know what year this was, perchance? About 300 to 325? And then in 350, what do you start to see the rise of? The Roman Catholic Church. And so which emperor then would be the horrible emperor? And then you start seeing divisions within the Lord's church itself, as Adam talked about, different types of divisions taking place. Because now Christianity is accepted. And now all these worldly thoughts and influences come into play and into the church itself. So I'm not real certain it's Domitian that's being talked about here. I wonder if there's another one down the road. But I just kind of throw that out there for you to think about. The point is, I don't think we can take this literal. I think this is symbolic. And because I'm keeping with the way I interpret the book of Revelation. The ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have received no kingdom yet, but they received the authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. Ten kings, again, the number ten is symbolic of the fullness of power. The kings do not have power of their own, but temporarily power from the beast. Probably is representing the ten provinces of the empire, such as Herod, such as he was. So, you know, we can, these are all symbols, but I think you see that the symbols can lead to us coming to the conclusion that we are talking about Rome here in many ways. The point of the beast to not be overlooked is Rome's power is in her strength of her army. They had a powerful army, and the people loved Rome because they feared Rome. Just let you know that. They were a bully. They were vicious and destructive. And all you have to do is take a look at how Jerusalem was treated down by the Roman Empire in 70 AD. But the point of this, I mean, I spent a lot of time on this, and I'm only going to have 3 minutes to talk about the point of this chapter. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for He is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with Him are called chosen and faithful. This is the point of this chapter. Christ will be victorious. Those who oppose Christ shall not win, but be defeated. This is the point. She is beautiful. She has all this. People are wanting to flock to her. They want what she has. But in the end, notice the next verse. Because she has declared war on the King of Kings. Then he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitude, nations, and tongues, and the ten horns which you saw on the beast. These will hate the harlot and make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh and burn her with fire. Those who have become her allies are not her allies because they love her, but they want what she has to offer. And when she can't offer that anymore to them, she's going to destroy them. She's going to have anything to do with her. And I just want you to take the imagery of this in for just a second. That's her allies up on the PowerPoint. Those are her friends for centuries. Just kind of take that in for a second.
Prodigal son. All his buddies.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of the same thing as the United States, like you're saying. We have all these allies right now because of what we can provide.
Yep.
But we can't provide that anymore. We're
going to flock to our enemies. Yeah. Lessons, very quickly. Does the world truly have real friends they can rely on? How reliant are worldly friends? Christians are taught by Christ to be selfless, caring, giving, put others first, think of Acts and what the Christians did for one another on a regular basis. Our true friends are not of the world. Our true friends are Christians. What does this say to Christians and on whom they should rely, associate with, and look for advice? Do we look for and get guidance, advice, and help from our relationships, raising our children, business decisions, all areas of our lives? Do we look and get advice from other Christians, or do we look and get advice from the books that the world writes on how to do all this? Just kind of throw that out there for you to think about. Yeah.
I'll make a comment.
Go ahead.
To that slide in which you had mentioned earlier about your children. We have many families here with young children, and there are a lot of members here that have children that are grown and are willing to help. If parents don't know how to teach their children like you are on the six. And I think that's what your slide is saying. So
yep.
They're here to help. So
that's exactly right. And that's who you should look to. Get into a situation. And I'm telling you, there were situations that I got into, and Todd can verify, and David can too, when raising your children. I didn't know how to deal with them. I can't believe that Nicholas would do that. What do I do now? I didn't go on the internet and look for advice. I went to Mamaw Pence. And she normally said, beat his bottom. Okay. Just kind of throw that out there for you. That's what she would normally respond. There are times she would say, love him. But most of the time, he needs to be beaten. that's what we're talking about. Don't go on the internet. Don't get a book. Get a faithful Christian that's raised the children and ask them.
And faithful Christians who have children older than have tested and know what they're talking about.
Absolutely.
You don't necessarily go to somebody who has, I mean, there are times you go to someone who has a child the same age as you. Primarily, you need to be
somebody that's been through the war.
Through the experience.
And through the war. That's exactly right. All right. I got one verse left. I'll just read these two verses. For God has put in their hearts to fulfill his purpose, to be of one mind, and to give their kingdom to the beast, until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. I think you take that literally because that's how that's written. What we're talking about is the city of Rome here. So next week we'll start with chapter 18. Thank you for your thoughts. Thank you for your comments. If you have any questions or anything, you can ask me afterwards. Anytime. Thank you.